By way of introduction to visitors here or those that don't know me, I am a mission partner here at The Well. I work with SIM, and if you would like a little bit of light reading, you're welcome to grab one of these from the table in the foyer out the back. I head up SIM's anti-trafficking and exploitation ministry called For Freedom. And in September, on SIM's behalf, I attended the Global MICA consultation in Manila. And to be honest, I've been trying to process it ever since. So when I was talking about this with Clint, he said, well, why don't you come and, you know, share it with everybody here. So this morning, what I'm going to do is just share with you some of the experiences that have stayed with me from conference, the challenge it continues to bring me as I think about this verse from Micah chapter 6, verse 8. The Micah Network is an international network of Christians and Christian organizations and academics and practitioners who work in aid and development around the world, and they have these consultations every 3 years. It's a chance for members to get together to really wrestle with the question, what does it mean for us as followers of Jesus to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God? So this is the question I want to bring here this morning for us as individuals and for us as a church. We're at this sort of transition season in our church where we're starting, you know, we're asking questions. What are our values as a church here at The Well? What is our missional presence going to be going forward? How are we going to impact our local community? Maybe we need to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. So the Micah consultation brought together more than 460 people from 68 different countries, mostly from the global south or the developing world. To say that it was diverse would be a bit of an understatement. We heard speakers from Ethiopia, Lebanon, Kenya, India, Moldova, the UK, Germany, Bangladesh. I was in a discussion group that had people from Angola, Australia, South Sudan, Canada, Burkina Faso, Latvia, Brazil, Mongolia, and the Philippines. As a white Westerner, I was definitely in the minority, and this was a really interesting experience, and it was a real privilege to actually be able to step out of Western culture and sit amongst worldviews and cultures and experiences of those so different from my own. And it really challenged me about aspects of Western culture that aren't so great. Our individualism, our selfishness, and our arrogance, thinking that we have it sorted. It was an incredible opportunity to sit and listen and learn. And there's three things that I'd like to share with you. The first thing is about the diversity. And one of the most incredible things about being with such a diverse group was that when we worshipped, we didn't always, in fact, we didn't often worship in English. Thanks to, you know, phonetics being written underneath. I think we'll see the next one soon. We sang worship songs in Korean, in Mandarin, in Portuguese, in French, Swahili, in Russian. And this picture here, you can just see some heads at the top. We had a worship singer from Botswana. We had a guy leading the singing from Russia. The worship leader was from Kenya. There was another singer from South Korea. The drummer was from China. The keys player was from Germany. It was amazing, amazing diversity. And it really made me think, man, is this what Revelation talks about when it says, you know, every nation and every tongue will come before God and worship? It was phenomenal. But a lot of questions and discussions came from this as well. Yes, it's great that songs like, you know, How Great Is Our God are sung in many different languages and nations around the world. But the question came, why is it only English songs that get translated and used by churches? Why aren't churches around the world translating and singing, for example, Zulu songs from South Africa? Or worship songs from Russia? Because we sang some, probably quite badly, but they're really good. And this discussion, you know, was really interesting around the importance of Indigenous worship. of worshipping God through songs written in Indigenous languages. And I know that there's some here in our creative arts team who are really on a learning journey about what does it mean for us as a church in New Zealand and as a church at the Well to be from Aotearoa, to sing and bring worship in Te Reo. And I want to say to you guys, you know, be encouraged, because the conversation that is going on here is actually part of a much bigger conversation that God is stirring globally within the church. Second thing I want to share with you is the challenge it was to be surrounded by 468 people actively wrestling with this question of what does it mean to live by to live out Micah 6:8. Nobody there was a pew-sitting passive Christian. They were all wrestling with it, and I want to introduce you to three of them. Hopefully, next one. Have I missed it? Is there a photo there, Andy, that's got me with three other people? Okay, there isn't. I want to tell you about three people. One, my colleague Jackie, who came with me from SIM. She's Australian, she's from Melbourne, and she has a similar position, except she is our HIV and AIDS specialist. She's based in Chiang Mai. And for her, acting justly and loving mercy meant leaving her home in Melbourne to advocate and care for those affected by HIV. And she is changing the mindset for people with HIV that there is life, that it's not a death sentence, that there is still hope. And she's doing this in many, many countries around the world. Another friend I made over there was called Lovelyn, and she's from Johannesburg. She's 28, and she has scars down her shoulder, her neck, and her upper arm from being shot by the police, protesting for the right for black South Africans to have equal access to university education. I thought apartheid finished in 1994. But there is still an ongoing battle for black and coloured South Africans to have equal rights within their nation. And one of these things is with tertiary education. And she was saying it is next to impossible for black or coloured South Africans to be able to have access that they can afford at universities. And she feels passionately called to do something about this because, as she said, I'm a follower of Jesus. And Jesus has told me to act justly, seeking justice and equality for all, and she's prepared to get shot for doing that. Another woman I met is called Sajda, and she's 32. She's from Pakistan. She's single in an Islamic country that not only persecutes Christians, but where it's incredibly difficult to exist as an unmarried woman. And 12 years ago, instead of getting married like all her peers, God broke her heart for the Christian children who live in her local villages. And she explained that in her area in Pakistan, there are many villages that are all kind of connected together. Each village has about 5,000 people in it, and they are just about all Muslim. Each village has between 50 to 100 Christians living in it, and they are there as the slaves. They are there in forced labor. They are there in domestic servitude. They are there being sexually exploited. They are there working like slaves in brick kilns. And she decided to do something about it. She has set up a school to try and break the cycle for these Christian kids living in these Muslim slave-like villages so that they can have a chance at education and a chance to break free. She has more than 220 kids in her school. She's doing it on her own. She's teaching them, she's loving them, and it's coming at a huge, huge cost, because in doing this, she's upsetting the economic balance in these villages. The Christian parents are loving the chance that their children are having the chance to go to school, that they're not going to be forced into slavery, but the Muslim majority are really unimpressed that their source of future workers is being taken away. She regularly gets death threats. She's really scared. She is so stressed. But she's continuing to walk with God to act justly, and she's wrestling with this cost of loving mercy. There are another 465 people just like them. The third thing I want to share that I've come back with is this horrible realization, really, of how little we know, and if we're honest, how little we really care about what is going on in the world. I just want to say this is not going to be particularly pleasant. If you would like to go to the bathroom or get a cup of tea, put your fingers in your ears, or just go to your happy place, please feel free. Probably the most impacting session I heard was when two guys just got up and asked if they could talk with us about what's happening in their country. And they said, "We want to tell you this because none of you know, and we need your help." And they are from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is this country right smack bang in the middle of Africa. One was a pastor and one was an Anglican bishop. And they are up in the northeastern corner of this country, on the border of Uganda. They told us that in DRC, one in every two women has been raped multiple times. They told us that along the border with Uganda, there is a big national park, it's a big forest. And they told us that in this forest, there are ISIS terrorists living there. And they told us that every day, these groups of terrorists leave the forests and they go through local villages. They round up whoever they can find, men, women, and children. They take them back into the forest. They line them up in a line and they slaughter them on a chopping block, one at a time. They told us, "We are being killed like goats, and nobody knows." They also told us in DRC, ironically, it's a country with the highest number of UN peacekeepers in the world. Did you know that? 22,000 UN peacekeepers are currently in DRC. They're actively deployed there, but they're not up in this northeastern region where all these massacres are occurring. They're down in the south of the country where the cobalt mines are, making sure that nothing disrupts the mining and the exporting of the cobalt that makes the batteries that we use in our mobile phones, laptops, and electric cars. 80% of the world's cobalt is used in our technology comes from DRC, and it is mined with slaves, and it is mined by children. And hearing all of this stuff was really confronting. Meeting people like this was really challenging. And unfortunately for my extremely green husband, it affected us straight away. Because before I went, we were kind of researching buying a new car. We were seriously considering going electric. But after hearing this and meeting these guys, I came home and said, "I'm sorry, babe, I can't. It's bad enough I've got a smartphone. Bad enough I've got a laptop. I can't knowingly purchase a car that is fueled like this." So we've got a Mazda 3. Good compromise. But it really highlighted to me, you know, how little we know here in New Zealand. And it's really caused me to come home reflecting on this verse. We're a million miles away from so much of this stuff. We don't have this kind of confrontational stuff going on right in front of us, but it still caused me to be really thinking, you know, well, what does it mean here for me, for you, for us, in Christchurch, at the Well? What does it mean for us to act justly? What does it mean for us to love mercy? And what does it mean for us to walk humbly with God? So because I'm not a fan of just taking a single verse on its own, we're just going to dive for a little minute into Micah chapter 6, so we can kind of see the context for where this verse has come from before we try to answer these questions. I think it's on page 650 of your green Bibles if you want to read it. Micah 6:8, "He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? So Micah is an Old Testament prophet. He's one of what we call 12 minor prophets in the Bible. He was a contemporary of Isaiah, of Amos, and Hosea. And he wrote this book in the 8th century BC, at a time when Assyria was the reigning superpower that was pretty much taking over what today we would call the Middle East, and a time when Israel was struggling under idolatrous and corrupt leaders. As a nation, Israel was rebelling and hardening their hearts against God. And Micah wrote this book describing God's coming judgment on Israel because of their rebellion. Micah prophesied that first the Assyrians and then the Babylonians would come and destroy Israel and leave Jerusalem in ruin. But Micah also gave them hope, and he told them that one day God would gather them up, that he would rebuild Jerusalem, and that he will defeat evil forever, set a messianic king to rule over all people, and that he will come and bless all nations. And he lays all of this out in the first 5 chapters. It's a very, very quick overview. But I think as well, for us to really get the relevance of this today and the relevance of verse 8 that is about to come, we need to read and understand this chapter, putting ourselves in the place of Israel. And then we get to chapter 6, which is kind of like this amazing climax in this book. It's full of imagery and, I don't know if you call it an analogy. Where's Ginny? I need my English teacher to correct me. Yeah. But what happens in this chapter is that Micah lays out this imagined conversation between God and Israel, where God is bringing Israel before him in a court of law. And in some versions, this chapter is actually headed up with a heading that says, "In the court of the Lord." So it starts in verse 1 and 2, and if you can imagine in your mind, kind of like this, a big courtroom, and we've got God up the front behind his big desk, banging his gavel, and he says, "Hear now what the Lord says. Arise, come and plead your case." You notice all the legal language? "Come and plead it before the jury, who are the mountains. Let the hills hear your voice. Hear you, mountains, the Lord's complaint, and you strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a complaint against his people, and I will contend against Israel." This whole chapter is written from the point of view of a courtroom drama. And Micah describes this with Israel coming on trial as the sort of guilty defendant before the Lord in the presence of these unshakable witnesses in the jury, the mountains, the hills, the foundations of the earth. And the court comes to order. In verse 3 and to 5, the Lord is there saying, "Look, my people, what have I done to you? How have I burdened you? Testify against me, for I brought you up out of Egypt. I freed you from slavery. I sent you Moses and Aaron and Miriam." And then Israel steps up to the witness stand. And God says, "What have I done to you?" And Israel stands there and gets this chance to speak. And Israel says, "Well, what can I do? What do you want? I don't know what to do. You want me to come before the Lord? You want me to bow before you? You want burnt offerings? Do you want me to give money or rams or oil? Do you want my firstborn? What do you want from me?" And then God is the judge. Really gently speaks, verse 8, and says, I've shown you what is good. I've shown you what I require of you, and it's actually not complicated. It's very simple. I just need you to do 3 things. I need you to act justly, I need you to love mercy, and I need you to walk humbly with me." And church, the challenge is that that's still what he requires from us today. So how do we do it? Let's dive into this very simple sounding little verse. To act justly means to act with justice. And if we look at biblical justice, There's actually two meanings. The first understanding for us, if we are going to act justly, is that we have to care for the vulnerable. There's a Hebrew word, justice, and it's called mishpat, and it occurs more than 200 times in the Old Testament. Kind of indicates it might be important to God, yeah? Mishpat is the word that is used here, and at its most basic meaning, mishpat means to treat people fairly. And again, when we kind of pull back more layers and look at this explanation, there's another two possibilities. Mishpat means, on the one hand, acquitting or punishing or judging every person fairly and equally, exactly the same, regardless of their race or their social status. It's kind of the premise that anyone who does the same wrong should be given the same penalty. It is about giving fairness. But mishpat means more than just fair punishment or fair judgment. It also means giving people what they are due, giving people their rights. And back in Deuteronomy 18, it describes the priests of the tabernacle and how they should be supported by a certain percentage of the people's income. And this support is described as the priests' mishpat, which means what they are due or their right. So when we're thinking, what does it mean to act justly? Mishpat tells us it means treating people fairly, giving them what they are due, whether that's punishment or whether that is protection or whether that is care. And when you look at every place in the Old Testament, all 200 places where this word is used, it is followed by the same groups of people. Widows, orphans, immigrants, and the poor, the most vulnerable people amongst us. And God today is still telling us that we need to care for them. You see, in Old Testament times, these four groups had no social power. They lived in a very subsistence level, only days from starvation if any famine or unrest came up. Today, these groups might include refugees. They might include migrant workers. They might include homeless people. They might include single parents struggling on a benefit. The list could go on. But the Bible tells us that the mishpat, or the justness of a community, is evaluated by how it treats these groups. God loves and defends widows, orphans, immigrants, and the poor, and so should we. And this is what it means to act justly. It's not an optional extra. And this is something that working in the area that I work, I hear a lot from people, and I hear a lot from people in the church about, oh, it's great that you're called to do this. I couldn't do that. It's like, well, that's great. No one's asking you to do that, but you're still being asked to act justly. You're still being asked to care for the vulnerable. You're still being asked to protect those around you. And it's going to look different for every single one of us, but it's not an optional extra to being a follower of Jesus. It is something we all need to be doing. To understand biblical justice, there is another word as well that really rounds out this picture. And it is another Hebrew word called tzedakah, which is often translated as righteousness. And what this means, according to the Bible, to act justly, we have to live in right relationships, a right relationship with God and with those around us. And if you look at this verse in the New Living Translation, it actually reads, do what is right. Tzedakah means day-to-day living in right relationship with our family, with our community, and treating everyone with fairness and generosity. This is acting justly. Treating everyone fairly, caring for the vulnerable, doing what is right, and keeping in right relationships. Tim Keller, says this about Micah 6:8. He says, this verse is a summary of how God wants us to live, to walk humbly with God, to know him intimately and be attentive to what he desires and loves. And what does that consist of? The text says, do justice and love mercy, which it seems at first glance to be two different things, but they're not. The term for mercy is the Hebrew word chesed, which means God's unconditional grace and compassion. The word for justice is the Hebrew term mishpat. And Tim Keller says that in Micah 6:8, mishpat puts the emphasis on the action, chesed puts it on our heart, on the attitude or motive behind the action. So if acting justly involves an action, what we do, loving mercy involves the attitude behind that, and it sounds so easy. If I was to ask you guys, what do you think of when you hear the word mercy? How would you answer? It's pretty hard, eh? And I think, like that term, act justly, there's a whole lot more to the term love mercy as well. And I think most of us, our first response is we think, mercy, oh, that's just kindness. And while that's true, as our friend down the back just said, that really is only a part of being merciful. When I looked into this, I went through the dictionary to try and just unpack these tiny little two words. So if you bear with me, we're going to get to a much fuller definition of mercy. These are some definitions of mercy from the dictionary. It says, mercy is a quality that has to do with compassion, forgiveness, and leniency. Another definition, it's compassionate or kindly forbearance shown towards another. It's the disposition to be compassionate and forbearing. So I wanted a bit of clarity on some of those terms. So a disposition, that's like our characteristic heart attitude, our natural sort of default position. Mercy involves compassion. And compassion is a feeling of deep sympathy for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. So if we're being mercy, if we're being merciful, we're not just empathizing or sympathizing. We should be getting moved to the point where we want to do something to help. I don't know about you, but I had to look up the word forbearance. Wasn't much help because the first definition said it's the act of forbearing. So the next one was a bit more of a help. Forbearing means to refrain from or withhold. It means to be patient or self-controlled when subject to annoyance or provocation. And I don't know about you, but I'm not always particularly patient or self-controlled when I get annoyed, am I, love? So from this, we can get a definition of mercy that is a little bit more than kindness. Mercy, a natural heart attitude that forgives, that feels deep sympathy for those suffering and is compelled to do something to help, and is patient and self-controlled when being annoyed and provoked. I think I much preferred it when I just thought it meant being kind. But you see, this is what God requires of us. He requires us to be like this, to be somebody and to be a church that is forgiving, that not only feels sympathy but wants to do something to help and is patient and self-controlled. I find that a challenge. And we're also called here to walk humbly with our God. One thing that hit me in this very small verse is how active it is. You know, we're being told to get up and act, to alleviate, to help. And now we're being told we've got to get up and walk. One of the speakers at Micah was from Kenya, and he spoke about what he called the theology of the chair. And he did point out that he felt that in the West, we have a very well-developed theology of chair, in that we are very good at sitting on our chairs at church, agreeing with something, but we're not actually very good at then standing up and putting it into action. And he argued that in the West, we don't have a good theology of walking. We much prefer to sit in our chairs and let others do the walking. And yet here God is telling us what he requires us to do. He requires us to get up, get out of our chairs, and walk. You know, when Jesus called his disciples, he didn't say, "Hey, come and sit over there." He said, "Come, follow me, keep walking, and walk humbly, submitting our will to God." You know, we pray and we say, "Your kingdom come, your will be done." And that involves walking humbly, with not us not leading the way, with us not telling God where we should go, but letting him lead. We commit our ways to God, and we know that he will direct our paths. It's that journey of learning to trust God completely and continuing to walk, even when it means we walk in valleys of grief and death, or when we walk on paths that are so narrow we're terrified what's going to happen, or walking when we have no idea of the way ahead. It's about surrender. God's asking us to walk humbly with him, to surrender our desire for control to him. And when we do this, we'll find ourselves going where God would go. We walk with the hurting, the poor, the sick, and those others may wish to avoid. We walk humbly with our God. You see, to walk with someone, you've got to agree with someone. And you only really agree with someone once you've got to know someone, what they like, what they think, what that sort of thing. Usually, you don't go walking with someone you don't like, and usually, you don't go walking with someone you don't know. There's got to be a relationship, some bond of fellowship and connection here. See, walking together means being in the presence of that person. And this is what God is requiring of us, to walk always in his presence, holding tightly to the hand of God our Father. So it's simple, really. It's all we've got to do. Act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. This tiny little verse has stuck in my head since the beginning of September, and it is challenging me in my day-to-day life. How am I doing this? Am I doing this? Because God just keeps saying, "It's okay, I've shown you. This is what I require. I require you to act justly, to treat everyone fairly and equally, to care for the vulnerable, to live in right relationships, to do what is right. I require you to love mercy, which means forgiving easily, feeling deep sympathy for those who are suffering and helping them, and being patient and controlled when we get annoyed. And he requires us to keep walking humbly with him. Don't just sit there. He's saying, get out of your seat and walk with me. Let me lead and never let go of my hand." So church, as the worship team comes and we start to close our service with one last song, I would just like to invite you to join me in the challenge that this little verse brings. I don't know what God might be saying to you. If he's saying anything to you, you might have this way more sorted than I do. But I just think it's like so many little verses we see in the Bible. You know, someone once said to me, it's the small verses you've got to be careful of.